Okay, last time we were talking about Reconstruction and the populist movement. And in these movements we saw their attempt to solve certain problems that people had run against in this country. The attempt by the Negro people to win their democratic rights after the Civil War, and in the populist movement, the attempt of the small farmers to stop the historic process of monopoly capitalism driving them off the land. In both cases, we saw that they attempted to achieve this within the context of support of one section of the ruling class or another. In both cases, they failed. Now, I want to discuss coalition politics as it relates to the development of the CIO and to the present situation that we're now facing in the United States in relationship to coalition politics. But before we do that, as I promised you last time, I want to first begin by going over just what is coalition politics. It is very confused. Most students today in the anti-war movement believe coalition politics means whether you work in the Democratic Party or not. It doesn't mean that. It's only one way in which coalition politics expresses itself. Let me go way back to the very foundations of where the differences come from between those who support coalition politics and those who oppose coalition politics. The essence is the question of whether you believe that changes in the society can be brought about by reforming the present system or by overthrowing it. In the last analysis, this is the difference. Now let me tell you why. Let's assume that you believe that a basic problem, such as the war in Vietnam, or democratic rights for the Negro people, can be achieved within the system through reforming it. This can only mean that there must be a section of the ruling class, or the ruling class as a whole, will accept the establishment of this, the solving of this problem, that it's not against its class interest fundamentally, and therefore that within the fight in the system to reform it, one can and should seek to find that section of the ruling class or that approach to the ruling class which can make it accept the change you want. It would be foolhardy to take the course of throwing yourself against the whole system if the basic changes you want can be achieved within the system. And therefore, anyone who is a reformist or who believes that the necessary changes can be achieved through reforms should, and we strongly encourage them, if you strongly believe this, to attempt coalition politics. Because coalition politics is not a question of running elections or anything. It is the attempt to base your politics on the basis that a section or the ruling class as a whole can be won over to the program you are fighting for. Now, let us say you don't believe that is possible. Let us say you believe only a revolution can change the problem. This means you believe that the class that's in power, the ruling class, must be disposed to solve the problem. That this class is irreconcilably opposed to solving the problem. In fact, in most cases, historically, you would say that the class is the cause of the problem and therefore cannot remove it. It would be absolute insanity to base yourself on trying to find a friendly section or to try to win this class over to your program, which is its destruction. Therefore, if your perspective on ending the war, on solving any of the basic problems that mankind faces, living in the United States in 1966 under capitalism, if you believe that the system can be reformed, then the logical conclusion is to engage in coalition politics. That is, to seek an alliance to win a section of the ruling class to your program and to back that section and to mobilize pressure for backing it. Now, the question of the Democratic Party has tended to be confused with the question of coalition politics because since the defeat of the populists in 1896, as I pointed out, the capitalists in the United States developed a myth in the whole basis of approach to the developing movements on the theory of what they call the two-party system, which is taught to you from the time you can go to school. that the two-party system is sort of God-ordained, it's great, it works wonderful. From the capitalist point of view, they're just expressing through the school system their own thinking. And no nation in the capitalist nation in the world did they have such control over the political life. And it's been the achievement of this two-party system and precisely the Democratic Party since its development after it defeated Reconstruction and defeated the populist. With those two achievements under its belt, the Democratic Party was the vehicle which was best fitted for containing and blocking and destroying any motion towards independent political action on the basis of oppressed people in the country. And by independent political action, I do not mean just running candidates. I mean just organizing independently, talking about running the government, talking about being the rulers, talking about changing the society with your own hands. That's independent political action. The anti-war committees that exist today are independent political action, though they don't run candidates, because they're independent from the power structure and they're seeking to solve it as against the power structure, not by trying to find a section, not the whole anti-war movement, of course. I'm talking about the independent committees like the VDCs. Most of the anti-war movement, or the people who would be included in it, most layers of it, are for coalition politics, either consciously or unconsciously. I'll discuss that later. So another aspect to it, and that is that the bourgeoisie in this country, in electoral candidates and in politics in general, has raised the concept, and it stems right out of the development of the bourgeoisie and of capitalism itself, that you've got to look towards individuals. The movement or the people themselves never make changes. It's that they find a leader who can express what they want. They find an individual who's capable. And that's taught to you from when you're a kid. You go to vote for candidates, and what are you taught? Look for the man. See, never they don't say to you, you ought to look for what movement represents what you're for, or what class in society. You're always taught to look for the man. And this tremendous myth is built up and continuously perpetrated. For instance, take the myth that LBJ makes decisions. Every president, no matter who he is, the minute he's elected, the myth machine goes to work to make the impression that he really is the decision-making, and that he is a very superhuman type thing. No matter who it is, no matter which one wins, the ruling class as a whole does this. And the politics in the society is also permeated with that. So that if someone runs independently in an electoral ticket as an individual, we judge them first of all on their program. That is, what do they say? What is it they want to achieve and how do they want to achieve it? You can be completely independent of the Democratic Party and be engaging in coalition politics. Completely and entirely. Your whole purpose could be that the Democratic and Republican Party are not doing the right type of job to win over the ruling class. That is, by the way, formally the position of SDS. So I will show a little later, I'll give you a quote from them, which they actually say in those many words, that what you've got to do is get outside the Democratic and Republican Party, be independent of it, in order to be able to influence the ruling class by putting the right type of pressure on it. Now, the essence of independent political action is to drive a wedge between the oppressed and the oppressor, to put one against the other. And in classical Marxist terms, it's the question of class collaboration versus class struggle. And the essence of coalition politics is to seek some sort of class collaboration as a means to solve a problem. And the essence of independent political action is to seek class struggle as a means to solve a problem. And this in a political arena, naturally, in the context of which we're living today, the number one question before the working class of America is its break from the Democratic Party in its political organizations and in its political formations. And therefore, the whole question tends to cycle simply around the question of the Democratic Party. But it's a much deeper question. And it's revealed in the actions that the anti-war committees, that everything, that every organization, whether it be civil rights or anything, takes in their day-to-day lives. They're either engaging in coalition politics or they're intensifying the class struggle to one degree or another, sometimes contradictorily, but that in itself is coalition politics or independent political action. It's not just a question of running candidates. Now, let's go to the CIO and its rise. When we discussed the Reconstruction and populist, we noted that both of these movements, the Reconstruction being based on the rural proletariat of the freed slave, populace on the small farm owner, the CIO was qualitatively different. The CIO based itself on the revolutionary class that can change society. the working class. It is not a class that's dying, it's a class that's growing. It's not a class that's peripheral to the function of capitalism, it's the class that's fundamental to it, cannot exist without it. And every deeper development of capitalism, every bigger factory, ever more intense colonization and expansion of the capitalism only intensifies and strengthens the class. It is the class that can take on capitalism. And therefore, it moving, as it did when the CIO was built, a social movement was a prelude, an opening shot in the war between the classes that must be decisive in this country, between the two classes that really face each other. It wasn't the first battle the working class in the United States had entered into, but it was a very qualitatively new phenomenon because it drew into it millions upon millions of workers. It drew into it the mass layers of the working class and its key industries in the country, and brought about industrial unions, the first real mass organizations of that type of the working class. And the CIO and the rise of trade unions in this country is not understood by the anti-war movement, the student radical, and sometimes even misunderstood by YSAers. Got to remember that what Marx said about class struggle happens to be true, that the ruling class and the working class face each other in continuous and irreconcilable struggle, and that the relationship between the two basically in the last analysis comes down to brute force. The estate apparatus of the capitalist class and all the weakness it has is dependent upon how much it's dependent upon the working class to be able to rule. That is, every victory the working class makes against it is weakening it. Think about this. Could the United States Army today be ordered to fire dead on into a United Auto Workers strike? Very unlikely. Very unlikely that the Army would be capable, and if it did it once, it would be odd that it could do it more than a couple of times at best. Because that, the consciousness and the mass of the American people, the victories that have been brought, that the right to have a union, the right to strike, these are victories because it permeates the mass of the exploited, and they cannot easily destroy that. Just because they happen to have control over the armor, officers' caste, and the soldiers, and so forth, doesn't mean that they are all powerful, as the student tends to think, because he doesn't understand the relationship between classes. The victory of the CIO and the trade unions is like our first line of defense against reaction. It is what prevents the capitalist class from doing many, many other things. And it is only because of the reactionary leadership of the unions that the capitalists can do a lot of what they do. The CIO is a power, and the unions today are a power in this country that is unparalleled in the working class movements of the world. And we should understand that. That victory cannot just be taken away. That victory to try to destroy the unions would be a mammoth battle in which the capitalist class trembles with the thought of ever having to even take the question on. And all the reactionary moods and reactionary attitudes of workers and all the bourgeois ideology except, nevertheless does not cut across that fundamental gain that's been won with the rise of the CIO. And it is weakened. They're always chipping away and knocking this union a little bit and that union. They might even destroy a union here or there. But that general rise, which that social movement, which rose up in 36 and 37, which created the CIO and the trade union movement as we know it today, is a formidable victory for the class, which puts it in a much better position for the next battle and which makes it much harder for the capitalists to rule over us. And that's got to be understood, because we can't see the context of what's going to happen in America or understand the past history and what's developing without really understanding what the trade union movement is. Now, I say all that in the positive before I begin to discuss what happened in the political arena, so that I don't mislead in any way. Now, right from the start, right from the time the CIO rose, it had one arm tied behind its back, and that was its political arm. It fought the bosses, direct one boss, you know, the owner of the factory or the corporation that owned the factory directly. Did not fight the bosses politically. It did not challenge them to who's going to govern. And by not so doing, the capitalists had continuously had the advantage of not having any challenge whatsoever on the political scene and the governmental level, and were able to come down and fight the CIO with both arms while the CIO was tied by one. And the question becomes why? Well, This is very important because, like I said, this is not a question now just of history, though history is very valuable. In fact, it's crucial to understand when we talk about Reconstruction or the populist movement, much to be learned from them. But the battle we're talking about now is still on. You see, it's not over. It's still on, and we're going to, our whole life, this question that confronted the CIO and the defeats it took because it did not create a Labor Party, because it did not form its political arm, are going to face us. And therefore, we really got to understand this well and understand why they didn't come about, what was the cause of it, so that we do not let it happen again at the next opportunity. Now, the key to the question, of course, is the question of leadership. The AFL trade union bureaucracy, of which the leadership of the CIO was a split off, started the CIO, right from the start, engaged the CIO in politics, in quotes. One of the things that differentiated the AFL, or the CIO from the AFL right at the beginning wasn't just that they carried out militant strikes or that they were organizing industrial unions, so these things did characterize them different. One thing that characterized them, right from the start, they organized themselves for political struggle. And what they organized themselves to do was to win over Roosevelt and the section of the ruling class he represented, to side with them in their faction fights with the AFL, and to try to create a coalition where the trade union bureaucrats would have it easier and would be able to solve some of the problems by negotiating with this section of the ruling class. They formed trade union labor political organizations for the purpose of supporting good Democrats. They formed a Labor Party in New York for the purpose of supporting Democrats. Don't let that shock you. The Labor Party can be formed for the purpose of coalition politics. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's not good. The formation of the Labor Party depends on how the workers understand and what an opponent leadership can make of it. We worked within the Labor Party, the Minnesota Labor Party and others, in trying to give them class line to make them real organs of the working class. But as a whole, what they did was they engaged in straight out and out coalition politics by using the unions and keeping them tied to the Roosevelt, to the so-called liberal capitalists, to the Democratic Party. Now, you might ask, but were the workers opposed to this? Weren't they for it? Was it really possible to do anything else? The truth is that even to this day, if the leadership of the unions moved for the formation of a trade union party, a party based on the trade unions, a labor party, they would have with them the overwhelming majority of the workers. Because the workers are not opposed to the formation of a labor party. What it is that they don't think it's realistic because they can't get their own union. Anyone that does get the idea, they can't get their own unions to move on it. But in 1936 and 37, and again in 1943, and again in 1945 and 46, the ranks pushed for a labor party. When the United Auto Workers was founded at their founding convention, they voted unanimously for the formation of a labor party. They had in Michigan, during the mid-40s, they had a continuous uprisings in the ranks of the trade unions demanding a labor party. To the end, they finally ended up with a semi-formation that then dissolved in a short period. The United Auto Workers have been in the lead on this question over year after year in passing resolutions and making demands. In in the late 40s, they invited a professor to come to speak at a convention. And this professor got up, I think it was 47, got up and made a long talk, and his whole point was how the labor movement was just tying its hands behind its back by not having a labor party. And by the time he got through speaking, he gets this monstrous standing ovation from all the delegates, and there you saw that if someone would just stand up and fight for it, the ranks would be for it. The thing with workers, of course, as any working class is the same as in this country, they don't just stick their own necks out. They have the instinct of understanding from where the way they live in their being that you've got to move as a whole. And if they don't see the trade union doing it, then they don't think it's realistic. Now, the opportunities to form a labor party have existed there all along. So what we have to examine is what leadership prevented the formation of a labor party. First most, and in essence, it was the trade union bureaucracy. That is, a formation within the trade unions that has special privileges, that sees as its fundamental task to maintain those privileges, and therefore seeks to coexist with the capitalists within the capitalist world in order to maintain their privileges. But that, we also have to diagnose the trade union bureaucracy in terms of what tendencies it represented. Who made up the trade union bureaucracy? And most certainly, we have the question, what was the socialist movement doing? Because one would, of course, expect the socialist movement, by definition, is supposed to mean those conscious workers who are for class struggle, for the betterment of the working class. And don't ever believe that is the definition anymore by people who call themselves socialists, because chances are, when a person comes around and puts the label socialist or even communist on himself, you're not talking to a socialist or a communist. And as we know, as all of you know, this was most certainly true in the 1930s and 40s. What made it possible to block the formation of a labor party in the first, in the last analysis, in the sense of the fight, the struggle that could have been led, was the fact that the socialist movement was dominated by a reformist tendency, a tendency that sought not to solve the problems of the American workers through revolution. In fact, it didn't even seek to solve the problems of the American workers. It was the Communist Party, which based itself on trying to create an alliance with one or another section of the capitalist class in support of whatever policies were in the best interest, as they saw them, of the Soviet bureaucracy in Russia. Now, that's a pretty out-and-out flat statement, but that's what the essence of the matter was, that the communist parties after 1928 rapidly developed in the degeneration and the rise of Stalinism in Russia, so that what motivated their actions, no matter whether they were on a right swing or a left swing or whatever it was the attempt of the Soviet bureaucracy, just like a trade union bureaucracy, to coexist with capitalism by finding some capitalists they can work with. They wanted to coexist on a world scale with capitalism by finding one section of the capitalists who they could exist with. Whether it was French capitalism or American capitalism or a section of the French capitalists or a section of the American capitalists, this was their one and only concern. So when the trade union movement rose, their line as to what the trade union movement should do politically simply depended upon what was in the interest and what was the direction in which the Soviet bureaucracy wanted them to go, and that the interest of which they thought they should go. Now, I think that it is very important that we all realize now, in 1966, what this meant. A tremendous historic opportunity was lost. The Communist Party reached control of something as high as one-third of the CIOs. They had numerically in position to fight for a Labor Party and probably win. If we were in the similar position, there would be no question that we would have had a Labor Party, if not something much better than that, and that would be a mass revolutionary party. That defeat left the American working class tied down and handicapped in such a way that all the defeats that we have met since then, like the witch hunt, the Korean War, and today the Vietnamese War, it is 100 times harder to fight back because we don't have a political formation like a Labor Party. And regardless of who would have led it or how it would have been led, such a formation would have given open up the avenues of struggle 100 times better than what we have today. Now, the Communist Party did everything it could, and it was sufficient, Communist Parties proved sufficient for this, to stop the formation of a Labor Party. And you've got to understand that Stalinism and the Communist Party know no limits to what they will do. No limits. You try to guess a limit. Take a limit. Just guess it. Will they, you know, try to break a strike? Of course they'll try to break strikes. Will they lie, you know, about revolutionaries? Of course they'll lie about revolutionaries. Will they, you know, where's the limit? Well, fortunately, mankind has achieved the ability to write. And therefore, though the CP would like to burn a lot of the things they have written, in fact, they usually like to burn anything that was written over a year old, we have certain copies of their material which they cannot now make disappear. So I want to document to you some of the things the Communist Party stood for, so that you see this in real life. And I want to do it in the context of the most difficult period for American labor, when the United States went into an imperialist war. When the United States ruling class, in its struggle against other capitalist classes, went out to conquer the markets of Asia and of Latin America and of Europe. And when, in order to do this, they had to whip everybody in line and they had to start trying to inch at that trade union movement and smash it in any way they could, hold down the line of the wages on the workers, when all the propaganda machine, when all the weight of the capitalism and all the chauvinism and patriotism and everything they can whip up, all the backwardness in the masses, all the racism, everything was full at work, when the class most needs leadership, that's when I want to talk about what the Communist Party did. Now, I have a book. And I want to quote to you what a Virgil Jordan, president of the National Industrial Conference Board, speaking to the Convention of the Investment Bankers Association, said. Now, what you're getting here is a man-to-man talk among the capitalists as to what the war is all about. Whatever the outcome of the war, America has embarked upon a career of imperialism, both in world affairs and in every other aspect of her life. Even though, by our aid, England should emerge from this struggle without defeat, she will be so impoverished economically and crippled in prestige that it is improbable she will be able to resume or maintain the dominant position in world affairs which she has occupied so long. At best, England will become a junior partner in an Anglo-Saxon imperialism in which the economic resources and the military and naval strength of the United States will be the center of gravity. Southward in our hemisphere and westward in the Pacific, the path of the empire takes its way. And in modern times, terms of economic power, as well as political prestige, the, how do you pronounce it? Scepter passes to the United States. All this is what lies beneath the phrase national defense. Some of it deeply hidden, some of it very near the surface, and soon to emerge to challenge us. Now, this was the Second World War. Now, the CP, led by an extremely intelligent man, Earl Browder, and who never really knew how he came in or how he went out, but he did both very dramatically. And he wrote up and explained what the Second World War was, and let me now clarify your minds on this question. What was the nature of the Second World War? The class nature? The character of the war is a people's war of national liberation. And we're talking about China. We're talking about the United States. We had a war of national liberation. Now, that was the nature of the war. Now, who will lead this war for our national liberation? One would assume that it's the Communist Party in support of the four block of four classes or something. No. As spokesman for the Communist Party, I declare that we subordinate every issue to this one imperative necessity of national unity under the nation's commander-in-chief to win the war. Let me just let you in on history. The commander-in-chief, he means Roosevelt, president of American imperialism. Now, is he the only possible leader that this country could have in this war of national liberation? Roosevelt is our national commander-in-chief, and victory is possible only by upholding his hands and defeating the obstructionists and fifth columnists who are his domestic enemies. Now, who is the domestic enemy of the capitalist class? The working class. And what they mean is that they, the working class, is going to pay for this war, is going to do the fighting, is going to do the dying for Roosevelt. You think I'm exaggerating? Who will pay for this war? An attempt to interpret literally the phrase equality of sacrifice would, of course, not help prosecute the war to victory, but would hopelessly sabotage it. There is not and cannot be any literal equality of sacrifice as between workers and capitalists in this war. The workers must make the main sacrifices, and they have enough common sense to know it. Now, what do you do if a worker objects? Doesn't quite agree. We were vilified as murderers because we explained and justified the Soviet Union's purges of the fifth column traitors, the Trotskyites and the Bukharinites, who had entered the service of Hitler and the Mikado. Who dares to raise this issue against the American Communist Party today? But one may say, aren't you communist? Aren't communists supposed to? You know what the manifesto says? The fear of the world, the ruling class, as the specter of communism rises? To all those who are still haunted by the specter of communism, we offer the services of the Communist Party itself to lay this ghost. Now, what about colonialism? Aren't we an imperialist nation that engages in colonialism? Thus, in Cuba, the Communist Party of that country fused with another party of the left in the Union Revolucionario Comunista and is an important sector of the Democratic Coalition, which elected Fulgencio Batista to the presidency of that country. There is still much to be done. Mind you, this is the Communist Party. This is the Communist Party, okay? There is still much to be done to dissipate the fear and suspicion of Yankee imperialism in order to create confidence throughout Latin America in the role of the United States as a leader of the United Nations. Now, is there anything else that you need to know about the role of the Communist Party? The Communist Party said, in effect, the working class, it said to the ruling class of this country, we are here. We have penetrated that class. We have our roots in the trade union movement, and we are at your service. Because the Soviet Union is under attack from the enemies of the American bourgeoisie, the bourgeoisie that happened to have sided the other way around, and we don't care anything about the working class. All we're interested in is what the bureaucracy happens to want at the moment. This is what they want. Now you would say, well, that's the way they are all along. They're just a reformist party. No. They switched their line. Why, one of the problems that Browder had in writing this book was he had to explain another book he wrote called The Way Out. Now, The Way Out was written, you see, while Browder had to explain the Hitler-Stalin Pact, in which, you see, the Communist Party in this country was left-wing, was opposed to war. Now, no, they're opposed to war today. They were opposed to war during the Hitler-Stalin Pact because they said, well, now you're not going to believe this, but Browder said, okay, now, let me get this. Well, let's see, what do I have? Well, first let me tell you this so you can have a good laugh. When he had to explain why they had opposed the war and how they had opposed Roosevelt, they actually called Roosevelt a fascist, which is wrong also. Everything they do is basically wrong because they stem from a wrong conception, you see, so everything they do is politically wrong. The way they explained it during the war was this. Now, this is just fantastic when you think about it. They say, the reason we opposed the United States going into the war in 38 and 39, 39 was because we realized, you see, we were so patriotic, that we realized, the Communist Party realized, that if the United States went to war against Germany by itself, and without the aid of the Soviet Union, it would have a very difficult war. While if we waited until the Soviet Union got in there, then as patriotic Americans, we move in and we give them the, you know, the punch while the Germans are rolling, and it's a real easy war for the United States, and we can win. You see how patriotic we were? We were waiting for the Soviet Union to move so that we, all along, we were really for the United States. The ruling classes of each warring camp reply, yes, we all want peace, but peace can come only through the victory of our side. Therefore, the only road to peace is to sacrifice everything for the war. Thus, the agents of finance and war profiteers try to turn the very aspirations for peace into the mightiest engine for war. The Communist Party's warning everybody, see? Not the victory of one or another imperialist camp is the road to peace, but the victory of the people over their war-making rulers in each country is the only way. What reason is there to believe that an Allied victory will bring anything better to the world than a German victory? There they were, right? Saying that we got to wait for the Soviet Union so we can get in there and fight. Now, it made no difference in the world whether there was a German victory and an Allied victory. Now, fundamentally, a lot of these phrases are correct in terms of class politics. But notice that, see? All of a sudden, there's no difference. The next day, oh, of course, whole class nature of the war changed. How did the war change? How did it change its class nature? Would the classes turn around? Did capitalists start working and workers start becoming capitalists? I mean, what happened? How did the whole class nature of this war change? Germany attacked the Soviet Union. Soviet bureaucracy, therefore, wanted now an alliance, not with Germany, but against Germany. Now, is the policy basically different? By the way, they made all types of statements, like Roosevelt is just like Hitler, there's no difference, and so on. Now, listen to this real carefully, and you'll see the coalition politics come through here. The way they continuously seek, their whole question is getting an alliance with the ruling class. Now, this is in their left period. This is when they're real revolutionaries. Here's what he writes. He's talking about the development of the imperialists all over the world and what's happening. Comes around to the United States and he says, most reactionary section went in the Hitler direction, while a liberal section rallied the masses to its support for a liberal experiment in progressive domestic and foreign policy to meet the crisis. This came to be identified as the New Deal and the good neighbor policies. Both of these are now dead. Mm-hmm, they turned them off. The Rooseveltism of the New Deal has capitulated to the reactionaries. Now do you see the line? See? It's whether the ruling class is carrying out what line they want or whether the line they don't want. In other words, Roosevelt, before he capitulated to the reactionaries, was really a good guy, but now he's capitulating. Not a class line. Not a question that it's like one class against another. It's what the capitalist class are doing. They're always looking to the capitalist class for their solutions. Even when they're talking as militant as hell and sounding real revolutionary, the essence of the line comes through. The change is which way is the ruling class going? This way or that way? Are they good or bad? Are they bad capitalists or good capitalists? It all comes down to trying forever to find the alliance. And they found it. All of a sudden, next year, they were in full support of Roosevelt, the commander-in-chief. Now, what about today? There's another friend of ours by the name of Gus Hall. Has a tendency to pen things. Bad mistake. These guys ought to learn how just to talk. Of course, now with tape recorders, we got them even on that score. But here, he's writing in 1960. There's the big anti-war movement developing, the peace movement, the stop-the-bomb business. And he's going to tell us how to end the Cold War. I strongly recommend you don't follow the advice. Now, why should we end the Cold War? Well, I'm sorry, let me take that back. Everybody read this if you get a chance. Because you see how it's not directed to workers, it's directed to the capitalist. Why they should, why it's to their advantage. Now, it happens to not be to their advantage, but they're desperately trying to find some section who they can try to convince, and that's their whole tactic. Now, let me show you. Let us discuss some of the facts which show the harm done by the Cold War policies. First of all, what has happened to the U.S. share of capitalist world production? Oh, we're not doing as well as we used to. Oh, billions of dollars in war. By 1960, the U.S. share of capitalist world production had declined from 58 to 45%. We had more than half. My goodness, we should always have more than half, shouldn't we? Something must be wrong. We're not doing as well, and probably the profit rate might even be dropping. My goodness, we've got to bring this Cold War to an end. But how do we get into it if it's not in our advantage? There was a bad capitalist, and his name... No, it's no joke. This is just the way they... His name was Churchill. He started the whole thing. He gave a talk. He got out there somewhere in the middle of the United States, I forget where, and he gave a talk. The old fox knew what he was doing. He gave a wrong lead as far as the United States was concerned. He had something different in mind than most Americans believed. It's obvious that Churchill and the American architects of the Cold War did not understand the moment nor the force of history. And you got all Churchill came over here, you see, and the British capitalists, they had all types of bad intentions. They always got the bad and good capitalists. In fact, he's got a scoreboard in this pamphlet on Kennedy. He scores them up and down. Baddie, good, bad, good, pretty good on civil rights, a little bad over here, shouldn't start the war in Vietnam, this, you know. And he scores them. And that's their attitude to class struggle. So everything is, the press should get down on their knees and look around for that good capitalist so they can all start praying for him. And that is, in essence, what their politics is. Now, with that type of party having hegemony within the socialist movement so that they outnumbered us 100-1 and controlled the CIO, unions after unions, were able to block us at every turn, you can understand why we suffered this unnecessary defeat in the class, why we could not have our own party, why we had to continue where we stood helpless before the two parties of capitalism. Because they had the hegemony in the radical movement, and it's their defeat within the radical movement, and only their defeat, that can assure that the next turn, that the whole movement won't be diverted and derailed. Now, the Democratic Party, from the capitalist point of view, has been very effective. By the way, you know, I just love to sit here and talk for about 2 hours just about the CP and its history, to see all the sides of it and how the capitalists used it, how when they didn't need it, just turned around and kicked it out the door. And how the Communist Party, the individuals in it, found themselves helpless and defenseless because all they had done is spend their time going up and down, chasing militants, red-baiting, and doing everything they could to break the power of the working class, and all of a sudden they find an attack on the capitalist class and they find themselves defenseless, of course. The only base where they could find support, the only people who are going to give anybody any support for their civil liberties is the working class. And if you spend all your time attacking it, you can't expect support. Well, let's go up to today in terms of the situation. It's very unlikely that we're going to have a Labor Party around the corner, though a lot of things may be in store for us around the corner. We're not sure. We have to be very patient and very conservative in our attitude regarding any immediate changes in the economy or anything like this, because the main thing we have to do is prepare ourselves and develop a cadre, socialist cadre, that can change the situation when it arises. But there may be changes in store for us not too long from now. But looking at the present situation, struggle has moved into different arenas. There's the Negro struggle, there's the anti-war struggle. Now, which way will it go? Both these struggles. Once again, the same fundamental question is posed. Will the movement move to seek independence from the ruling class, to build independent formations that fight against the ruling class, that continuously fight to broaden and to enter new and new forces into formations that are independent from the ruling class and that attack it? Or will the anti-war movement and the Negro struggle subordinate itself to trying to find goodies in the ruling class to support? Now, let me show you the mentality of the average student. Average student, not being in the working class, not having the faintest idea of the real power that exists in the relationship to production of the workers and their numbers. 30,000 or whatever it was in New York could tie up that New York City like this in one strike. 17,000 mechanics could tie down the airlines. That's real power. There's no way to stop that. There's no gimmick the ruling class can get around that question. Students is 5 million strong, but they can't do 1/10 of that. God, all we, if we just, the BDC had just had control of the means of transportation in the country, why, we'd stop the war by educating everybody else and carrying out the necessary actions. But that power is not understood. The only power that the student sees is the power of the ruling class. And so when a Wayne Morse or a Senator Gruning comes along and says, this war is evil, this war is bad, like Gruning, shoot him down in the Dominican Republic, but leave him alone over there, we want to trade with Asia, we're down up in Alaska, you know. whatever his motivation may be, doesn't matter what the individual motivation is, when he expresses that as a senator, as part of the ruling class, the student says, wow, there's power. See? Wayne Morris comes, he, Redwood City, 3,000 anti-war people. Every one of them, I believe an honest anti-war person is opposed to the war in Vietnam. Wayne Morris gets up there and says, we ought to support those individuals who are, you know, planning this thing and understanding. He names off Fulbright and some of these other people. And he says, we ought to get behind the Gavin Plan. You know what the Gavin Plan is? The United States should occupy Vietnam in the most economical way possible. That is, just take cities and set up little units, barricade yourself in real good, and then just go out there and raid and bomb the hell out of them. And don't waste any life. He gets up and says, we ought to support the Gavin Plan. And this whole crowd goes, yay! Applauding the very opposite of what they're for. But the man has power. He represents part of the ruling class. And they see within power, and they don't see power within themselves. They don't see a power within the unions. The unions are all lined up behind the war. They don't see power behind the civil rights organization, so that's beginning to change somewhat, because they wouldn't speak against the war, and they too supported Johnson. They too were part of this coalition. Now let me just quote to you. This is an article in the SDS, and I just got to read it tonight, and it has such an excellent phrase in it, I wanted to quote it to you. It's written attacking us, of course. Everybody's always attacking us. Around the NCC, there was a conference some of the supporters of the NCC held, and they booted two people who opposed coalition politics out of the meeting. They wouldn't let them sit because they said they're trots. And then he has this long thing. And then he finally gets near the end, and he's going to get real philosophical, and he's going to figure it out. He's going to tell us how we're going to end the war. Here's what he says. As for the possibility of stopping the war, my own feeling is, and then he talks a little about the national liberation will continue to fight. That students believe too. They really believe the colonial wars, and they're right about that, are going to continue to fight. That's very important that they understand that. Then he says, sons, brothers, husbands are going to be drafted and killed, and there's going to be inflation, there's going to be restrictions on labor, so it's very good. There's going to be increased tabling of necessary social reforms, that's all wonderful. So what's going to happen? The workers are going to rise up, there's going to be a new party, there's going to be a militant action, we're going to challenge the ruling class, the army will come over to our side, and we're going to solve this problem. Certain decisive elements in our society will come to feel that they don't want to pay the price, that they do want to bring the troops home, that they'll elect someone, who will bring peace. The anti-war movement can help articulate such feelings as these, but let's recognize that we won't be ending the war. In other words, we'll put a pressure on, and some of the capitalists will eventually, some of the people in power eventually recognize this. They'll elect one or two in there. They'll get, you know, maybe Bobby or somebody who will realize that this is all wrong and change. Now, that's a perspective out of desperation, because there isn't a single sign from the ruling class in any section of it whatsoever that they aren't for these wars and they aren't for smashing the colonial revolution. And more fundamental than whether you find a speaker here or there is show us economically how any class that is ruling over us, any section of that class can benefit by the victory of the colonial revolution and the political implications, because that is what you're talking about. You can't have it both ways. You can't say the ruling class is going to end this war and not say that it's in their interests to have it end, the war end. But that's the way most students feel, and we should try to understand that. They don't see the question of Democratic Party politics as principles, because they only see one power as the ruling class, and they look for every division within it and try to look to it. However, the average student is also suspicious that he's going to be sold out. He's suspicious of anybody over 30, and all the senators and representatives are over 30. He's suspicious of them because he's seen so many people that he's been told to support. And this, by the way, for our generation, starts with LBJ. Every organization went on record to put LBJ in that White House, that this was the thing to do. Get him the biggest possible vote, except for the YSA. We said the bigger the vote you get him, the more reactionary he's going to be, the more he can go to war, the more you've tied the hands of the people, the more you've tied the hands of the workers, the Negro people, and the students to protest. The more you just get behind them. And now, Du Bois Club isn't running around saying, gee, look, weren't we great, we supported LBJ. SDS isn't walking around with their buttons part of the way with LBJ. The only ones who talk about the LBJ question is the YSA. Now, We don't talk about our front groups openly, yeah. Now, let's take this in the concrete. Let's take this whole question in the concrete and see how it's affecting us right now, the movement we're working in, the movement we're giving our rest and sleep for, our blood and sweat for, the anti-war movement. What's happening? Well, let's look at the strongest possible position of those who support coalition politics. Take their strongest case and deal with it. Let's give them every benefit of the doubt in that sense. Let's look at the Scheer campaign. Scheer campaign is a classical example of an attempt to get militant activists, young students, to enter and to work for coalition politics. It's a classical example. It bases itself on radical, militant-sounding phrases in order to bring them in, and then gets them to work, in essence, for forming a wing within the Democratic Party in order to carry out a continuous program for coalition politics in which candidates are chosen on one or another basis. Scheer began, I'll never forget that day when the YSAs, we were trying to nail him down as much as we could at that BDC meeting. And I remember Sid Stapleton getting up and throwing at him, you'll be supporting other Democrats. He said, no, sir. By the end of the campaign, when every time he spoke, there was a lineup behind him that was so long you couldn't see where it ended, of Democrats getting on there, trying to get in on the legwork from the students. Now, let me just show you how the Scheer campaign began. Maybe you ever thought, how did it begin? Where was the conference that nominated Scheer? Did the anti-war movement call a conference and there was debate and different candidates were proposed and different alternatives? Should we maybe not run candidates? Should we maybe do one thing or another? How did Scheer become a candidate? Now, let me tell you. Scheer people, I have also learned how to write. And they wrote. Who is the Scheer for Congress committee? Good question. Last summer, a group of East Bay citizens attempted to convince Congressman Cohelan to publicly oppose the war. That's nothing wrong with that. It would be much better if they spent their time convincing working people about how to oppose the war. Dismayed by their failure, they began a search for a new candidate for Congress. Now, what have you got here? Got some people in the Cohelan camp, people that supported Cohelan, some people in the Democratic machine who went out and they opposed the war. They wanted another candidate to represent them. And so they started looking for one. But you just can't run a campaign out of the blue. You got to have workers. You got to have people that go door to door. And you can't just get these out of the blue, and especially when you're bucking the machine. You got to build your own machine. That takes money and it takes work. Now, they don't have money like the Democratic Party. They haven't got the tie-in with the trade union bureaucracy and all these other tie-ins. So you can't just build it out of the blue. You might be able to get the money, but you still got to get those workers. Well, during the same period, the Vietnam Day Committee sponsored a dramatic series of direct actions and marches. The participation in these events demonstrated that vast numbers of people in this district opposed the war. The success of the VDC suggested to many people that even greater opposition could be demonstrated in electoral activity. Very simple. There's a big anti-war movement coming along. Some people who are permanently engaged in coalition politics, sections of the petty bourgeoisie, the Communist Party, and other formations, see this large layer of new activist kids. How can we get them in there? Well, to get them in, you gotta have a militant candidate. So they got Scheer. And they came after that Vietnam Day Committee endorsement. They wanted that like they wanted blood. Not because they wanted the VDC. Not because they ever intended to use it. Because once they had that endorsement, then they could reach the kids and get them in the Scheer campaign. And I'll never forget, we came after YSAers, we caucused and everything. We were ready to go in there and try to teach somebody something over this. We went into those meetings and Scheer wouldn't show. And Reuben was back there maneuvering and counting, and he would count heads whether he's going to carry the vote or not. And at some meetings he said, geez, I can't carry the vote. I'll never forget, I caught him back there because I was sitting behind him while he's talking to caucusing. He says, Scheer, we can't win this meeting. Don't speak at this meeting. So next meeting comes. Finally, they get all their people together and they're going to have the final showdown. And they come in. And they fight and fight, and we our motion that Sit Stable and Put on the Floor was, we don't endorse, we don't oppose. Those who want to work, try this, fine. Those who want to work another way, fine. This is a place where we all work against the war. This is an independent committee which everyone is welcome. You don't force down its throat one candidate or another. That was the motion. Not that you have to support socialism, not that you have to make a principled declaration for independent politics, nothing of the sort. Just keep the unity of the anti-war movement. They wouldn't have nothing to do with it. They came in demanding, they must have that endorsement. They got it. They beat us 2-1, 110-55 was the vote. You know what? They never once printed on any of their literature the fact that VDC endorsed them. They didn't need it after that. They had it, they could get the kids, they got the kids, they destroyed the VDC in essence. It went downhill straight from then on, with a couple of little eruptions before it faltered, before it was rebuilt. And from then on in their literature, I may be wrong about this, because they put out a hell of a lot of literature. I tried to keep up with it, but I couldn't do it. They did a, you know that Scheer spent more on his campaign than any other person has ever spent in the state of California, except for a statewide election. And so it's hard to keep up. But in almost all his stuff, never does it mention the VDC. In fact, here's one of his pieces. U.S. Congress, 7th Congressional, Bob Scheer. And I have a whole mess of them here. They always mention the fact the CDC, the Democratic Council, supports Scheer. In fact, the Women for Peace. And one could theoretically predict that if we were right, if this was the essence and the meaning of the Scheer campaign, then the Scheer campaign would come in conflict when the independent committees against the war carried out actions which alienated sections of the middle class and alienated their attempt to build some sort of coalition within those layers in the Democratic Party. That could be a theoretical preposition from our stand. And that's exactly what happened when on April 12th, the VDC attempted a demonstration in which there was a minor element of civil disobedience when people spoke over a microphone in violation of a sound ordinance, which proved to be unconstitutional. Now, let me just point out something to you. In Port Chicago right now, there are people throwing themselves in front of trucks, which are clear violation of the law. Now, we don't, you know, we don't necessarily agree with this tactic. We admire people, no matter who's got their heart in the right place and is opposed to this war. But there isn't a word out of Scheer against that. Not a word. But when the VDC, an independent anti-war committee, militantly just violated the sound ordinance, the next day on campus we were faced with a lineup of their speakers to attack the independent war committee, the VDC, about how we were tricking people, how we were manipulating, how we were doing this, how we were running dangers of getting people hurt, this and that, everything to disassociate themselves. Scheer wasn't even present and wouldn't be. So that tended to confirm for people who might have doubts as to the nature of the VDC campaign. Now, Scheer himself is being perfectly honest. Scheer, the man, is a perfectly honest politician. He was asked at one of the VDC meetings, are you for capitalism, are you for socialism? He said, I'm for capitalism. He's for capitalism, he wants to end the war. Now, why shouldn't he join his class's party? And why shouldn't he work with them? He says he's opposed to the Democratic Party. What he means is opposed to the policies that Democratic Party has. If it would modify his policies, he wouldn't be opposed to it. He says he's been a registered Democrat all his life and that he'll be one. He sees no principle involved in any way because it's just a question within his class, though he doesn't think in those terms. The class that he supports. And we got to respect the man. He's a capitalist politician, the extreme left wing of the capitalist politicians. But we know that there can be no end to this war under capitalism. And that's the question that must be entered in your mind before you even begin this year campaign. There's no use discussing whether it's right or wrong if you don't know yet, if you haven't decided in your own mind whether the war in Vietnam and what that means, the whole colonial revolution, the whole danger of war, the whole existence of imperialism, and what it means in terms of war and peace. If you're not sure that that can be solved by the present ruling class, if you're not absolutely sure that it cannot, then the Scheer campaign is not unreasonable. But as socialists, what we try to do, of course, is to educate and to explain the class nature of our society and the fact that we are going to face these wars from here on in. In fact, we're going to face the very danger of the death of all mankind if capitalism and the war-making power is not taken out of their hands. Now, tomorrow Betsy's going to give a talk in the Black Panther Party. But I want to say one other thing. I won't go all the way. I'll stop at this point. I want to say one other thing about this immediate period in the context of the anti-war movement. Just as Berkeley, the mystical radical center of America, was debating whether to go out and try to recruit every Negro we could in the ghetto to the Democratic Party, exact same time, a very courageous small section of the working class in Lowndes County was breaking from capitalist politics, stepping out on their own, just a few thousand strong, taking on the whole system and declaring their independence. They would be no party to the Democratic Party. They would have nothing to do with the people. Here they were, stepping out, forming their own formation. And what was the student movement doing in Berkeley? Going out into the ghetto, telling them about the Black Panther Party? Telling them about the people who are standing up on their own? No, registering them into the party of war and racism. And telling them, we got a good one this year. He's so goddamn good, he's against war and racism. He's running in the same party, by the way, you have to register here, thank you very much. And how did they run Scheer? This is a new movement. Join our movement, let's liberate ourselves. No. No, it wasn't called the anti-war movement, the Black Panther Party.
That's what it was called.
Scheer. The Scheer campaign. I couldn't find it, but I was dying to look for it, and I gotta find it. God, I can't lose that. It's a pamphlet that says, Scheer is concerned about your children. Not wonderful to know that? I bet you every Negro family that saw that was extremely, extremely pleased to find out that there was a man, in spite of his beard, who was concerned about their children. And you know, I'm sure they were extremely happy, and they were just wished that, you know, that this might have some results. But I suspect also that no one expected in the ghetto, just out of class instinct, that they were going to solve their problems this way. No, in fact, the Scheer campaign is a classical bourgeois campaign in the way it was run. It wasn't based on building a movement. It wasn't based on laying a groundwork. It wasn't based like the Black Panther Party is. John Hewlett, the chairman of the party, won't run as a candidate precisely because he doesn't want to make it a one-man thing, precisely because he wants the representatives to come out of the people and not just the leaders stand up as the candidate. He wants it to be a movement. He wants it to live beyond the elections. And he tries to base it on the people through their actions, their organization. They decide the candidates. What is the Scheer campaign? Just the opposite. A brilliant scholar, backed up by 58,000 macaronis, stands up and looks to the militants and say, come and you've got to support me, I'm running for Congress. And why? Because I oppose the war. And now go out and recruit the Negro people who live in this community who haven't gotten around to be registered by either the trade union bureaucrats, the Uncle Toms, or anybody else who works in the Democratic Party. You get out there and pick up those who've had questions in their minds, who don't like the Democratic Party, or are beginning to break. You go convince them to get back in. Now, of course, they never said that. That's the essence. That's what they did. They went among the students who are thinking against this war. Well, I remember Sid said a lot of good things at that meeting. I hope that's taped. I don't think it is. He said, what we should be doing is burning membership cards in the Democratic Party. That would be an action that might have some impact in Washington and that might scare them off. Going out and recruiting to the Democratic Party sure won't. Now, the question that's posed before us is, what is the future? Is it the Black Panther or is it Scheer? Is it the type of independent action where working people in this country begin to join the millions throughout the world who are tired of being oppressed, who
who begin to understand what this system is doing to their lives and it's done to past generations, and that there can be no solution under this system, begin the struggle for socialism to change it? Or are we going to join the game of trying to find a millionaire who agrees with us? Are we going to join the game of subordinating what we stand for, what we need, in order to find an ally within the ruling class? That's the choice. And I wanted to say a few other things about the Black Panther, but I want to leave that for Betsy tomorrow. Actually, she should have gone first, so I'm very nervous all the time that I'm going to say things that she's going to talk about. Now, let me just end up with one last thing about coalition politics in this period. There's not going to be, taking the present objective conditions, a mass turn to independent political action. We're going to be on the defensive in this period for quite a while. The average member of the anti-war committees looks upon the question as a tactic from his viewpoint within the class struggle, from the point of view of which he can see, as I describe what it is. Therefore, we've got to be extremely patient. We've got to go through this long period. But history has shown that it's not what you can do in the immediate that's the last analysis. That it's when the class as a class moves, the relationships of forces between reformists and revolutionaries, those who want to lead when the masses are ready to move, that have an apparatus who can turn to them and win them to a program, a revolutionary program, and what the relationship between them and those who approach it with a reformist program. And that relationship will express itself in the cadre of the YSA versus the cadre of the reformist tendencies. The CP in the first instance, the Yipsel, if we can find it, in the second. And from that score, all our patience and all our hard work in this period in winning new allies, in winning people to think about socialism, to open their minds, and to winning new cadre for the YSA, we can actually lay the groundwork for winning the battles when the time comes that we can settle the questions that the world is facing in a definitive and final way, which will be the creation of a socialist society. Anybody got any questions, comments, disagreement, arguments, motions? Do you think I exaggerated? Dave?
On the news about a week ago, the Rampart editor, Keating and a couple of other candidates said that they're fed up with Brown, they're fed up with Reagan, and they're going to start out on their own, form their own, an independent party of the Democrats. And I'd like to hear your analysis of it, and whether or not you're going to support this.
Yeah. Very serious question. See, to carry the question to its logical conclusion, the question is, how do you determine when a political motion is independent and when it isn't? There are many borderline cases. The history of the SWP is one in which every time there has been a borderline case, the parties attempted to give the question of the doubt to the borderline case. But this this question involved now is not a borderline. This is a rather clear one. Three ways, you can use a rule of thumb as to approaching any formation, which Cannon outlined in 1948
in his explanation of the Progressive Party. First, you look at its program. Never mind what class is supporting it or what class it's made up, what class does it support? And don't forget that in the last analysis, everything is classes. Marx was right about that, not wrong, he was right. Our society is made up of classes. There are people who work for a living, there are people that own. And that's the fundamental basis upon which their objective interests are made. Now that just happens to be true. It may be unfortunate, you may not like it, the professors don't like it, Keating may not know about it, but it's true. And because it is true, you've got to look at it that way. Theory is worthless if it doesn't describe reality. But if it does describe reality, you are insane to throw it out the window. And Marx happens to be describing the reality of 1966 America. We are living in a class society. Now, what class is Keating supporting? Well, you look at his program. Calls nowhere for a party of the working class. He wants a party that's independent. It's going to be independent, Democratic and Republican. Now, we know that number two is not magical. There could be three capitalist parties. It could be five. It could be 10. It could be 20. It could be one. Most likely what Keating thinks he's doing is setting up a non-class party or group. It's not based on any one class. Now, with the context of American politics today, and with the context of the fact we do live in a class society, and the fact that Keating has no class base, well, let me tell you something else. Okay, the program is number one. Now, we just look at his program straightforward. There's nothing in it that calls for a class political action, working class, or anything of the sort. Number two, the next thing you look at is how does it turn out in action? What does this person actually do? Does he get up and make speeches about how workers must work, break from the Democratic Party because we need working people need their party of their own? Or does he get up and say, wise thinking people who have looked over the situation believe that we should end this war, period. In other words, as a class orientation, his actions are not geared in his speeches or in the way he lives or what he does, organizations he joins, or anything else. And the very fact that it's built on individuals and not a movement itself shows that it's not oriented toward the working class. And third thing you watch for is the class composition of the group involved. Well, most certainly Keating is an intellectual. He's not made up. It's not a party of workers. You can have a party of workers that's got a bourgeois program. And the attitude we take to that sometimes is quite different. Because we can try to convince workers to change their program. But there's no use getting into a party whose program, actions, and base is non-working class. No, we, of course, wouldn't support him any more than we supported the Wallace movement. And if you got questions on this, go back and read the bulletin that the YSA put out on the Progressive Party, written by Cannon back then at the time. When the Progressive Party, it was the CP, when the Cold War began, it thought it had found a section of the capitalist class that agreed with it for coexistence. And they only had one good capitalist, and that was Wallace, and they did just like the Scheer campaign. It became called the Wallace Movement for an individual. The program was liberal capitalism. He even talked about he was going to nationalize the railroad or two and stuff like that. That was bait. But they based it, their program was pro-capitalist. They wanted the Wallace section of the capitalist class, which didn't include much beyond Wallace, to run the country. And they based their active, and they're getting their membership and their work from radicals, from the labor movement, from the student movement, from the Negro movement. And they try to build a third liberal capitalist party. We opposed it. As soon as war broke out, Wallace was for it. As soon as the Korean War broke out. Now, I don't want to go into this because it's quite involved to deal with the whole question of just when a party can be called a working class. I'll try to give you an outline of how to think about it, but the other thing to take in mind is you've got to work out every individual case in context. It depends upon the context and the nature of the class struggle at that time. To really make that clear, imagine that a radicalization engulfs America and thousands upon tens of thousands of people start joining the Socialist Workers' Party. And in this process, the trade union bureaucrats want to set up a labor party to cut off the development. We would oppose it. So there's no yes or no on these questions. It depends on the context. And in the context of today, Keating's elections are for the purpose and the effect they have, whether he subjectively wants to or not, it's got nothing to do with it. The effect they have is to draw from the anti-war movement kids away from anti-war propaganda to work within the Democratic Party, to work in support of electoral capitalist candidates, pro-bourgeois candidates. By the way, the hardest thing for people to learn is that there's classes. Once you master that, you can move along pretty fast. That is, if you choose the right class. But the hardest thing for students to do is to learn there are classes. And a lot of times students will sit down, and you'll sit down trying to recruit someone to the YSA, and you sit down for hours and you don't understand why you're not making any headway. They seem to agree about Vietnam, they seem to agree about civil rights, they agree about a whole mess of stuff, but they never really agree that their classes exist, and therefore they cannot understand why in the world you want to seek the type of solution that you want. And it's the hardest thing to convince because of the present American context when the class is not moving as a class politically. Okay, questions? Yes, Martin. Class has no political arm. You know, there's no party of its own. And that's what Engels was addressing himself to. And you're absolutely right about that. And you know, in raising it, that's the fundamental. The demand we raise right now, and the SWP has been raising, is the formation of a labor party. We haven't raised yet what type of program we want it to have. Once it were established, our whole emphasis would begin is to fight for a socialist program within the labor party. But the question before is the break. But you have to be careful and not formulate it, and I know you didn't intend this, but I'm just saying in general, to not formulate it simply on composition. Because it has another context, that actual establishment of a class party. So you got the Liberal Party in New York, it's a capitalist party, and it's based upon some trade unions. Its composition could be called the working class, but its essence and the whole direction is it's just another capitalist party. And it's not gear itself, or does it strive to be in any way a working class party. But that is the problem we face. And until that problem is crossed in one way or another, there can be no solution and no building of a mass movement that can change this country until the working class breaks politically from capitalist politics.
We have to define principle two mean by composition, that it's the ties between the class supposedly within this party and the party. The working class is in the Democratic Party. That's what the Communist Party says. But they're not in it as workers. They're in it on the basis of their neighborhoods, their regions. All the Democratic Party caucuses cut across class lines completely. There's no tie between a union. A union carries no weight in the Democratic Party. It doesn't vote as a union. It doesn't carry a block of votes.
Yeah, the workers are in the Democratic Party in the sense that every year the Democrats convince them that the Republican is such a son of a bitch that they ought to vote against him. And occasionally they're so convinced by the dirty politics of the Democrats that they go out and vote Republican to stop that son of a bitch. And that is the level at which the class as a class is participating in politics at this point. The average worker doesn't belong to any political club. He doesn't go to any meetings. He doesn't decide anything. He's got nothing to do with it.
whatever party he's registered in.
I was kind of, not disappointed, but to me, while the sheer campaign was going on, I don't think it could have been attacked, at that time with the whirlwind force that it had. But the details, the everyday details of what was happening, should really, more attention should have been paid. You brought out, a few of them, some of the most salient points. A couple others that I noticed were, after this guy that wrote this letter, this Dr. Neil Simon and these others went out and got Scheer, there was a big march in Oakland. Already had Scheer as a candidate. And they had a demonstration and a rally afterwards, and Rubin got up there, Rubin being the leader of the DDC, one of the strongest left-wing promoters of Bob Scheer. And he got up and made an extremely coy speech saying, we're trying to get Bob to run. It had already been settled, Mike. But there's this honesty involved in this. And another thing, which is the same thing as that demonstration in the street. Now, the demonstration that took place in April that Pete mentioned, on part of the benefits of people in L.A. and Canada, was based on the demonstration in the streets in Vietnam. We wanted to show our solidarity with them. At the time of the election, the precinct where I went to vote, somebody was handing out a little white piece of paper and said, while people in Vietnam have to demonstrate in the streets and strike, something for that, I said, you here in the quiet of your voting booth can determine whether there will be war or peace.
Brian raised a very important question. That's, how do you carry out a fight? What's the tactics? What should we do? I'm sure that we didn't do it the best way. It's very hard to do things the best way. One of the problems we faced in combating Scheer was that the best way to do it wasn't just to make a broadside attack and have a political discussion that was way above the political understanding of the overmajority of people that are participating in it, simply because they're not socialists, simply because they're not sure there's classes, simply because from all this, it's very hard. And what we continue to try to do, is to present our general position very, very carefully, very quietly, and very patiently through the YS and talking to people. At the same time, we try to keep alive an independent anti-war movement, a movement that's independent of the Democratic Party. And through that, by living examples, show how to fight the war without capitulating, without supporting the ruling class. And combining both those tactics, one can be much more effective. But there's also times, it's also a purely tactical question. Sometimes it's better, and of course we did within the anti-war movement, the time when the Scheer asked for endorsement of the BDC, we just took him on straightforward and explained why he shouldn't. And we'll do that any time of the week, because our goal is for making a revolution in this country, not over whether next week or not we're popular or not. As revolutionaries, we're going to be extremely unpopular in this country for quite a while. People aren't revolutionaries. Maybe all types of people red baiting us. Sometimes you get red baited by reds. By some of these cheer on the commander in chief reds, you get red baited all the time. And as such, you see, we can't bend to this. There might come a day when we have to run a candidate when we should. It'd be the correct thing to do is to run a candidate against cheer. We will. And, if it should come. At this point, the best thing for us to do, I think, is what we did. Patiently explain. I think we want a lot of people to realize that there's more to the question. I think we want a lot of people to realize that they ought to think it out carefully. And I think we got a lot of people nervous about the fact that they're working to support the Democratic Party. And more than that, I think we have very clearly won some people over to opposing independent opposing coalition politics, and in fact even recruited to the YSA out of the Scheer campaign.
Yeah, the thought you brought out a few weeks ago, assuming that Scheer does run for mayor, and a similar tactic that he used for BDC will be pulled with the United Committee, what could be done in order to defeat this action without encouraging a split in the organization, or a ruination of it as happened in the BDC?
our number one concern in that situation, that is, if the BDC debate should take place again, is once again to prevent a split in the anti-war movement. We have tried, and I don't think anyone can say honestly, the YSAers haven't tried, but we're human, and we get excited too, occasionally, to build an anti-war movement which will welcome and include anyone who is opposed to this war, who is for self-determination in Vietnam, regardless of what they think on other questions. And we want to, that's the type of committee we should try to fight for in the United Committee. And this is, would be our line, that we don't endorse or not endorse, but that we welcome both.
Well, students want action. I'm just elaborating kind of what you're saying in a concrete way. They want action, and when they ever hear anyone say, well, let's stop and think about it, or let's not do something, like let's not run, let's not support Scheer. Whenever they hear, let's not do this without let's do that, as opposed to it, they get very irritated because they want to do something.
Yeah.
No matter if it's right or wrong, they want to do something. And it isn't quite so dramatic, or it wasn't then, in February or December, whenever that question was raised, not to support a political candidate, because people said, well, we're tired of running around in the streets. What we want to do is have political action. They didn't care whether it was right political action or wrong political action. They wanted political action. And it was a very difficult question to deal with because the only political action that was possible at that time was wrong political action in the sense of running candidates.
Right, make that very clear.
Yeah, right.
It's on the electoral scene, that may be the case at the moment. And even we should be very clear, using the electoral means. The fact, you see, Lenin in his pamphlet, you know, the classical example of the student belief of a Trotskyites. Students call us Trotskyites. There's no Trotskyites alive that I know. There are Trotskyists. The difference is a Trotskyite is one who believes in the man, is one who believes in the ideas of the man. And we believe in the ideas of Leon Trotsky, so we don't care if you can call us Trotsky, that's perfectly okay with us. We can call them what we think they are too, and then be perfectly okay with us too. But we shouldn't forget that when, as Lenin, what I was trying to say was that as a Trotsky, I'll quote Lenin. Lenin in the left-wing infantile disorder, whatever it is, communist, left-wing communist infantile disorder, points out that one of the most difficult periods to work in is when you're in a reactionary period, when there isn't mass motion. And that in those periods, it's extremely important to take advantage of any aspect of bourgeois democracy, and especially something like electoral activity. Because you have a good chance to reach the masses, to speak to them, and so forth. And right now, the SAP is running a top-notch campaign in New York City, in which they got Judy White running for governor of New York State, and she'll be the youngest governor New York has ever had. She was just rewarded a medal up at Boston for her anti-war work by some reverend of some sort. We ought to find out what denomination it is. Make sure the Sparrow says it's the right denomination. And they're engaging in electoral politics, and it's 100% valuable. You get TV time, you get radio time, you get all this. It's extremely valuable. And therefore, for Christ's sake, when you argue on this question, get it down to the basic question that's involved, the class question. Don't argue about whether Scheer's doing a good job or not opposing the war, or even whether this vote isn't really an anti-war vote. It most certainly is. Those people who voted for Scheer were trying to vote against the war. No use kidding ourselves about that. It may not be the way to end the war, but that's just fact. And it's true as a whole that Scheer stuck to his line for withdrawal. That is also a fact. It's true they slipped in negotiations every now and then, but that's not what made it wrong. In fact, coming out for withdrawal made it more wrong in a sense in that it fooled more people who were militants. And so we don't argue on the question of electoral politics, whether it's good or bad, because it's good if it's used correctly. It's a very powerful weapon. And I'm sorry, Brian?
Just one other thing. sure people get this in their mind, they might remember those who were at the meeting, which is the vote was 2-1 to endorse Scheer. The majority of the people there, however, did not like the idea of a Democratic Party, of a capitalist party campaign. They said, Scheer is running. That was a fait accompli for them. There this guy has decided to run. As a matter of fact, that very morning, or if not, it might have been the day before, was when he announced to a press conference that he was running. So that's what they had. The students were faced with the fact, well, here's something going on. And even though the majority of them, and I'd say about a 2-1 the other way, did not like the particular nature of that campaign, they still were stuck with Scheer, and they were stuck with this thing that Pete said is drumming into you all the time. This is the man. Here's the man who's written 2 books. Wow.
That's right. It's absolutely true.
Well, what mine should buy out something else, too, which is a trap that probably would be very easy to fall into any time. There were 2 or 3 BDC meetings in which the question of the Scheer campaign or whether Scheer was going to run came up before the meeting when the vote was taken. And one of the big questions was whether or not Scheer was going to run as an independent. And it was made very clear to the BDC, at any rate, that what Scheer really wanted was to run as an independent. And so there was a committee appointed to find out and to investigate whether or not Scheer could run, whether a person could successfully run as an independent. And then they came back and reported to us that all of the facts showed that it would just be impossible to run anyone successfully as an independent. And at that point, you know, we said, well, all right, we've got it. You know, it's important to run an anti-war candidate. If there's no successful way to get him on the ballot as an independent, then we'll have to accept you running as a Democrat.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yes?
There is a successful way to run candidates independently in the Bay Area.